Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in National Association of Independent Insurers versus Department of Insurance.
May it please the court. Mr. Desmond D. McCallum will present argument to petitioners. Petitioners are reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Counsel. This case arose as a challenge by numerous insurance companies and trade associations to two rules adopted by the now-defunct State Board of Insurance. The rules are referred to as Rule 1000 and Rule 1003.
Does the power the State Board have now devolved to the Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
The Commissioner could repeal these rules?
The Commissioner could, yes. These rules were adopted by that last State Board of Insurance on the last day before that board's authority expired. In May of 1993, the legislature had terminated that board's authority to adopt general rules effective September 1, 1993. The rules were and are challenged by petitioners on all grounds set out in Section 13F of Article 2121 of the Texas Insurance Code, the article under which the board finally said it purported to adopt these rules. As you know, the Administrative Procedure Act and our other statutes specify grounds for invalidity of rules. However, the legislature in Section 13F of Article 2121 said that rules are invalid if they violate a constitutional or state statutory provision, if they exceed the statutory authority of the board, if they are arbitrary or capricious, if they are too vague, if they are made on unlawful procedure, or if they are clearly erroneous. In addition, these rules were challenged by petitioners for failure of the board to comply substantially with the requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act imposed by the legislature on agencies when they, one, first publish a rule proposed for adoption, and secondly, when they finally enter an order adopting the rule. The provisions of the APA specifically are Section 0.035. A rule is not valid unless adopted in substantial compliance with Sections 023 through 034. 024 requires that notice of a proposed rule must include a concise explanation of the statutory provisions under which the rule is proposed. 033 is the reasoned justification requirement, and it requires that the final order contain a summary of comments from parties and why the agency disagrees with those comments, a restatement of the rule's factual bases, and a concise restatement of the statutory provisions and how the agency interprets those provisions as authorizing or requiring rule. The court's notice granting petitioner's application in this case indicates that the focus is upon these Administrative Procedure Act points, and our arguments will certainly concentrate in that area.
Mr. McCullough, is it your position that the department has no authority to determine what practice is fair and unfair?
Absolutely not. There are, this department enumerated no standards.
I understand. They do not have the authority, or do you disagree with my statement?
No, they do have the authority to determine that a given act or practice is an unfair or deceptive practice.
Isn't that what they've done in this case?
That's what they have called it. That's exactly right. But
that's the authority that they exercised in promulgating these rules.
That's what they tried to do. But the practices that they proscribed and called unfair trade practices are not unfair trade practices, and there is no explanation in the board order as to a factual basis for why these are unfair trade practices, nor is there any explanation of what an unfair trade practice is. What the board tried to do in this case, in addition to creating the treble damage lawsuits, which have now been eradicated, thank goodness, by the legislature, because of this rule, these rules, and others like them, what the board tried to do was, in addition to that, to take over and prescribe the underwriting decisions, legitimate business decisions that companies may make under the guise of 2121 by controlling those underwriting decisions by calling them unfair trade practices without telling us why they are unfair trade practices, and without following, the Federal Trade Commission has promulgated the definition, more or less, of unfair trade practices that the board never apparently considered at all. And they cited on page 41 of our application whether the practice offends public policy or is considered unlawful, and whether it is immoral, unethical, oppressive, or unscrupulous, and whether it causes substantial injury to consumers or competitors or other businessmen.
Are you saying that the denial of insurance to a consumer simply because they've been blacklisted by another insurance company is not unfair?
It depends on your term of blacklisting, and that is the favorite pejorative of the board in this order, as you will see in reading the order. The view of the board is that if an agent or a company turns down someone because they had 6 accidents in 6 months, they are blacklisted by that company. And if another company has the same guidelines, they are blacklisted by that company. Blacklisting, as the board defines it, is exactly that. But the point I return to is that the board has used that sort of term, and it endeavors to, as you will see, provide greater availability and greater affordability of insurance in this state through the guise of acting under Article 2121. The point there is that the legislature of this state has never given the State Board of Insurance or any commissioner of insurance authority to make insurance more affordable and more available. The respondents, the board, have never been able to cite any statute that purports to give the board, that authority, and yet, as you see in the language of the order, that is exactly what the board endeavored to do in this case, in addition to creating the prevalent damage lawsuit. And that's the crux of this case. They're simply, in addition to other arbitrary and capricious facets of the rule that I'll talk about in a minute, there simply was no evidence of these being unfair trade practices.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Powell, one of the rules purports to say, you use the facts of 6 actions, one of the rules purports to say that unless the insurer does its own investigation that leads it to the same conclusion as a previous insurer for denying insurance, the new insurance company cannot simply rely on the denial of insurance by another company as a basis for denying insurance.
I wish.
Now, well, did you understand what I'm setting up?
I understand the portion of the rule you're talking about.
Okay. Why can't the insurance board, under the guise of determining what's a fair or unfair practice, say it's an unfair practice for an insurance company to deny coverage merely because some other insurance company had denied coverage? Why can't they say that's unfair?
Well, there are two reasons. One, why can they say it's unfair? What is unfair about that trade practice in the language of the FTC definition that I just read to you? The board didn't pay any attention to that definition, had no definition of its own, no standard. But more than that, and it is extremely interesting that you use the language that was used by the Austin Court of Appeals in their opinion when they say that this rule is designed to prevent insurance companies from taking that action merely because they previously had been rejected by another insurer. That's the language in the Court of Appeals. That is not what the rule said. As you know from reading the rules, the rule provided that you cannot do that based in whole or in part. In whole or in part. In other words, the rule was written specifically so that any applicant who was denied insurance and who had in his or her history a previous cancellation or denial or insurance by a county mutual, which insures high-risk applicants, anyone who even had that in their background could sue that the reason, in part, they were denied the application for insurance was because of that previous cancellation, no matter how valid other reasons existed for the denial of that application. And that's exactly what the board representative said on the witness stand, was the purpose and intent of the rule. In other words, they wanted plaintiffs to be able to recover by obtaining a finding that any part, 1/100, no matter how infinitesimal, that the agent knew and considered that fact of previous denial or cancellation when the applicant was rejected, no matter what else valid reason existed for denial. So that's why this rule is invalid. If they had written the rule to say solely or merely or even on the basis of, there's a good chance we wouldn't be here today, except for other aspects of this particular ruling. But that's not what this board did, and they did it for a particular reason that I have outlined for you. And that is a large reason that the rule is exceedingly arbitrary and capricious. Now, the legislature, as I say, and let me say that the board, as far as factual bases for the rule, the board had no evidence, and we obtained this through discovery, that any company in the state of Texas was engaging in the practices that the board proscribed by Rule 1000. So why adopt the rule?
Is there a certain conflict there that you're arguing that such a rule is arbitrary, and yet apparently there's no evidence that any insurance company
was doing that? That's right. Why would the board pass a rule when the definition of an unfair trade practice requires the showing of substantial injury to consumers, and they could show none? Why would the board pass a rule that had that?
Why would the insurance companies object?
Because any time any applicant for insurance was denied and had a history of previous cancellation, no matter how valid the insurance company reason was, that is to say 10 accidents in 6 months, the plaintiff still had a cause of action to try to persuade a jury that in part, the
I thought the insurance company could consider the underlying reasons for the cancellation.
I don't understand.
Well,
the insurance company would argue, yes, we had a valid reason, but the plaintiff's counsel would argue, don't you know, that's a smokescreen. Really, it was in part because of this previous cancellation. So that's, the legislature, as I say, has removed less than the treble damage causes of action, but there still remains $25,000 per violation administrative penalties that are proper or possible under these same rules. Now, we don't have any concern about the present administration or commissioner, if you will, as far as that kind of unreasonable posture being taken. But I can guarantee you that if there's ever a commissioner again who is of the same persuasion as this board was and its commissioner before they left, there is grave cause for concern. But as I say, the bigger issue is the effort of the board under the guise of an unfair trade practice to control the underwriting practices of companies. Now,
if they're unfair.
And why? And if they tell us why? Of course, the requirement that the legislature has imposed in the Administrative Procedure Act is that they tell us why they're not there and the factual basis for it. And we don't have that in this case. We don't have it anywhere in this case. Now, the second rule precluded issuance or pricing of insurance on the number of cars on the policy. Well, there is a board rule, 74D, that conditions the pricing of insurance on the number of cars on a policy. So if the board has a rule that recognizes that there are differences in underwriting risk between those two, why would they pass a rule prohibiting a company from doing the same thing, only better for the consumer, than the board rule actually requires?
Any other questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear argument for response.
May it please the court, Mr. John M. Hohengarten will present argument for response.
May it please the court, I'm Jack Hohengarten, the Assistant Attorney General representing the Commissioner of Insurance and the Texas Department of Insurance in this case. With me today is Commissioner of Insurance Elton Vollmer. And with me today is Rod Borderlawn, the public counsel from OPEC. I think it's very important at the outset to clarify exactly what these rules do and what they do not do. Very simply, Rule 1000 tells an insurance company that in deciding whether or not to accept an applicant, it may not consider the fact that a previous company has decided to cancel or non-renew or refuse the risk. The underlying premise of the rule is obviously that the decision by the previous insurer in and of itself means nothing. There may be underlying reasons, and of course the second insurer is not prohibited from delving into those underlying reasons. So in essence, all Rule 1000 requires is that each company use its own underwriting criteria.
How does that make insurance more available and more affordable?
I think the idea is to generate competition by making sure that each company is using its own underwriting criteria, whatever that underwriting criteria may be, in basically assessing the risk rather than just piggybacking on the previous decision of an earlier insurer.
If their underwriting criteria are identical, there's no prohibition against denying the application for insurance.
That's correct, Justice Hornan. If the second insurer is making a decision based on the same factor that the previous insurer used, there's no violation of the rule as long as the second insurer would have relied on that factor regardless of its knowledge of what the first insurance company had done.
So how does it follow from that that insurance is somehow more available and more affordable?
Well, it allows insurance companies to have different underwriting criteria. Companies are not required to have the same type of underwriting criteria in order to comply with the rule. So I think what we're getting at is a diversity of analysis.
But what if insurance company B says our criteria is we won't cover somebody that's been canceled? That's our criteria. And that person just happens to come there. This rule won't let them do that.
That's right. That is the one exception. The underwriting criteria of the second company cannot include a factor that a previous company has canceled. Other than that factor, the second company is free to use any underwriting criteria.
But then the next step is that no company can have that as a criteria because it's outlawed. Is that right?
That's correct. No insurance company can have
that. So the next step is everybody has to not have that and they have to do their own investigation.
That's
the underlying fact.
That's correct.
And so that's Judge Cornyn's question. How does that make it more affordable and more available, particularly more affordable if they have to spend the money to do independent investigations on every case?
I think what the rules are getting to is that the company cannot have in its underwriting criteria that one factor, that is the factor that a previous company has canceled, because that decision in and of itself signifies nothing. But other than that one factor, every company is free to use its own criteria. And I would submit to Your Honor that we need to look at the other part of the equation, and that is that somebody applying for insurance may not get it simply because of a decision of a previous insurer, and that people who are trying to get insurance may be precluded from securing that insurance because of a decision of a previous company, which may have absolutely nothing to do with the risk. It may be that the previous company pulled out of the market, the previous company has severed its ties with the agency through which the policy was issued. The decision in and of itself is not significant. Apart from that, each company can use its own underwriting criteria.
Well, how do you answer his argument then that a cause is available for if it's just in part fact that somebody canceled or didn't renew or refused to insure that particular asset?
Well, the insurance companies are not to use the fact of the previous company's decision in their underwriting criteria. The rule is stringent in that regard, in that it is not supposed to be a part of the analysis. It's not enough for the company to say, well, we did not solely base our decision on what the previous company did. They would still be in violation of the rule if the action of the previous company is a part of the analysis.
But if you can't consider it, why can you ask about it? There are a lot of things I can't consider when I hire somebody, but I can't ask about them either.
The insurance industry wanted that clause so that it could be insured or it could be reassured that it can delve into the underlying reason for the previous company's actions. Because as I said at the outset, the underlying reason may well be relevant to the second insurer's underwriting criteria. The rule makes very clear that the second company is not in any way in violation in asking about the prior cancellation, because again, the underlying reasons for that cancellation may be relevant to the second insurer's underwriting criteria.
These are unrelated to any risk factors. However, the rule also prohibits consideration in whole or in part that this person has been insured by a county mutual or surplus lines carrier, which are high-risk insurance carriers, are they not?
Sometimes they are, but in many cases it may turn out that the person has wound up in a county mutual simply because the agent to whom that applicant went underwrites county mutuals. And so, again, the fact that the applicant was in a county mutual in and of itself may mean nothing. And, of course, the second insurer, once again, is not prohibited from taking the applicant through their criteria to discover why that applicant, or if there is a reason, why that applicant was in a county mutual, if the applicant being in a county mutual is a reflection of some sort of risk factor under the second insurer's underwriting criteria.
Well, aren't premiums for the county mutual insurance carriers much higher?
They often are. I believe they are.
Always?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that question.
So why would anybody buy insurance from a county mutual if they could qualify based upon the various risk factors that an insurance company might consider in underwriting a policy? Why would they pay county mutual rates when they could buy at preferred rates?
Well, again, it could just be that they haven't shopped around enough, that the agent to whom they went was only underwriting county mutual and they didn't check into it.
Or it may be because they're a bad driving risk.
Right, but if they are, nothing in the rule prohibits the second company from doing that analysis regarding the driving record. If the driving record is bad, and of course the driving record is going to be relevant to the second insurer's underwriting criteria, then the second insurer, in rejecting the risk, will not have in any way violated the rule.
Hypothetically, if someone were to ask, well, insurance company, why did you deny this application for insurance? And the evidence is, well, first of all, I heard that they were previously insured through a county mutual, but I didn't rely on that, but that caused me to conduct a further investigation, and we determined that they'd had multiple accidents and were thus mm-hmm. a higher risk. Would this rule prohibit that process?
Absolutely not, and the rule is very clear.
So that does not constitute reliance, consideration of that fact in part?
No, it doesn't, because all the second insurer has done is taken note that the applicant was previously in a county mutual and then taken that a step farther and done the investigation that the commissioner wants them to do, basically done the investigation and done the analysis under its own underwriting criteria. Having done that analysis, the second insurer discovers that, in fact, this applicant is a bad risk. He has a terrible driving record. The application is rejected. No violation of the rule.
Mr. Hohengarten, do you agree with Mr. McCalla that the board at this time did not have the authority to determine underwriting rules, or does it?
I think
Mr. McCalla said what they've done here is they've attempted to actually control underwriting rules under the guise of controlling unfair practices, and the legislature didn't give them the authority to control underwriting rules. Do you agree that the board cannot dictate underwriting rules for insurers?
My first response would be, in this case, the board did not, because each insurer is free.
I understand that's your argument, but do you agree that the insurance board cannot dictate underwriting rules?
The board of insurance could speak to the issue of underwriting criteria if an underwriting criteria was unfair. So to the extent that the board and now the commissioner can adopt rules.
Well, let's talk about the underwriting criteria then. Underwriting criteria that's unfair. Underwriting criteria is based on percentages, I suppose. So there's a whole class of incidences or people out there. And underwriting is based on this class, percentages. And in my expert opinion, I'm an underwriter, in my expert opinion, this person's a member of a class that's a high-risk class.
Mm-hmm.
They've got, you know, they've had a learner's permit for too many years, or they've had, you know, they've had a canceled driver's license. So because their driver's license got canceled, or because they've had three tickets within 1 year, this is indicative within a class of being a high risk. So I'm going to decide not to write to anybody that has that factual criteria, that factual background. Why isn't cancellation of an insurance policy because the vast majority that have them canceled are for some reason that the insurance company doesn't want to be a part of, other than I had a misunderstanding about when my premium was due? Why isn't that a legitimate underwriting criteria?
My response, Justice Enoch, would be because the decision in itself signifies nothing. There may be underlying reasons.
Statistically, a canceled policy indicates a certain conduct, doesn't it?
No, the policy, a canceled policy may indicate that the insurer, for example, has pulled out of the market.
That's right.
Or severed ties with...
And three speeding tickets may indicate that I had three children being born and these all happened to hit me at the same time I'm on the way to the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, but statistically, the reason that the policy got canceled may in fact be a valid reason that the second insurer wouldn't want to cover.
But in this case, all we're asking is that the insurer go to the next step and find out, and if I could just add...
Well, the insurance company has determined that that's unfair. It's unfair for the insurance company to rely on the mere cancellation of policy as an underwriting decision. If, taking your position, that if they determine the underwriting criteria is unfair, then they could change that. Are there findings, is there a listing of facts, findings of facts of conduct of insurers that demonstrates that relying on the canceled policy as an underwriting criteria is unfair? Is that anywhere in the record that the board found facts, conduct on the part of insurance companies that indicated that relying on a previous cancellation as a basis for not writing policy is unfair?
Yes. The reason justification states that such action is anti-competitive and results in the blacklisting of some consumers from the insurance market. And my concern is that that part has not gotten any emphasis in this oral argument, that what the commissioner and the board before him is trying to prohibit is a situation where families, applicants, prospective insurers are basically shut out of the market for no reason other than some previous insurer has made a decision, but we don't know what that decision signifies.
Mr. McCullough was arguing that there is no evidence of record.
I'm glad Your Honor raised that, because in this case, I think Mr. McCullough's legal theory is a very dangerous one, because it really precludes agencies from engaging in prophylactic prospective rulemaking. And in this case, the board has always been very upfront about the fact that Rule 1000 is a prophylactic prospective rule.
And ACRA does not require stating the reasons for the promulgation of that rule?
Oh, it does, absolutely. It has to state the rational basis, the logical nexus. It's supposed to state how the rule will operate, what the rule is supposed to accomplish. But Mr. McCullough's thesis is, or theory is, that the board had to state that there was actual conduct occurring and that consumers were actually being injured. If the court were to accept that argument, this rule is gone, because the board cannot and has not argued or try to assert that this rule is anything but a prospective prophylactic rule, and that is entirely consistent, of course, with Section 13 of Article 2121, which states that the commissioner can initiate a rulemaking procedure based on an activity that has been or could be false, deceptive, or misleading. So the legislature has clearly contemplated that the commissioner will have statutory authority to make prospective rules.
It's got to be based on something more than just speculation, doesn't it? That it could be. The rule the Administrative Procedure Act requires a restatement of the rule's factual basis.
Absolutely.
And you're saying an adequate factual basis might be the board's concern that something might become a problem in the future.
Yes, and this is critically important because many agencies have prospective rulemaking authority.
Thus, there's no requirement that what the concern is has actually ever occurred.
No, there couldn't be. If the court were to find that agencies could not do prospective rulemaking, and the very benefit of making policy through future-oriented rulemaking would be lost. And
so
basically what
so
you
the
would
factual
have...
Basis, the factual basis for this is the board was concerned that consumers might not be able to get automobile insurance?
The factual basis is that such action is anti-competitive and results in the blacklisting.
That's a conclusion, isn't it?
There's the blacklisting.
If you said that in an affidavit in support of a motion for summary judgment, wouldn't we, some court say that's conclusory?
Well, I'm glad Your Honor asked that question because it's very important to distinguish, I think, the contested cases in the APA from rulemaking. The procedures are entirely different, and rulemaking is not really a proceeding that results in an evidentiary record. Often the only thing you'll have in the, quote, rulemaking record, close quote, is the order itself.
So may it be based strictly on the conclusions of the agency?
No, it can't. Let me be very clear about this. The agency has to state in the four corners of the order it's the rational basis for the rule. It has to explain how it's proceeded from A to B. It has to set out what the concerns are, what the problem is, what the policy goal is, and how the rule operates to address the problem or advance the policy goal. With respect to interpreting factual basis, that would have to be what factual basis means when an agency has the statutory authority to make prospective rules. Because whenever you're making prospective rules, by definition, you are not going to have an evidentiary record as you would in the area of a contested case.
So is the necessity of a rule purely a matter of the opinion by the agency? The agency decides we need a rule, and nothing's occurred yet that would factually cause show the necessity for the rule, but based upon our judgment, we conclude that this could happen in the future, and therefore we promulgate a rule.
I think it has to be more than an opinion, but I will emphasize that Section 13 of Article 2121 in the Church Code does delegate to the Commissioner very broad authority to define practices as unfair. And that language is somewhat consistent with Your Honor's hypothetical in asking, can the agency basically render an opinion? The Commissioner does receive the authority from the legislature to define certain practices as unfair. But having said that, the Commissioner still must set out in the reason justification the factual basis. And the factual basis does have to describe the problem and does have to describe what the concerns are and how the rule will operate. But what factual basis does not need to show, or we would have basically a disastrous blending of contested cases and rulemaking cases, what the factual basis does not have to show is basically some sort of injury, ongoing activity resulting in consumer injury. Because if you require that, then henceforth every agency doing prospective rulemaking is drawn into a kind of bare-knuckled litigation regarding the factual underpinnings of its rulemaking. And that would be a very cumbersome, inefficient manner to set policy by rulemaking. I think the whole reason rulemaking has evolved is because there's a recognition that it can be very difficult to articulate a guiding general principle in a contested case. Because whenever you have a contested case before an agency and a result, you're going to have similarly situated individuals asking themselves, Am I under this rule or am I not? The only way you can find out is to do another contested case. Then 9 or 10 contested cases later, maybe we finally have a general principle that everybody understands.
So after this requirement of a factual basis can be supplied by an agency's determination that although something is not currently occurring, it may occur in the future.
Absolutely. That would have to be, and I think that's supported by the structure of the APA.
The only other question I have is under the assigned risk pools for automobile insurance. Is insurance available to every consumer in Texas?
I don't know the answer to your question, Your Honor, and I don't know that the record really fleshes that out. I know that there's a mandatory law that everyone driving have insurance. I think there is a concern, and there was a concern on the part of this board, that if you limit insurance by the number of vehicles a family owns, then some people may be shut out of the market just by virtue of the fact that they're a single-car family.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kim.
Please, the court, I'd like to reply to what I believe is the most important issue in this case, and one that hasn't surfaced in the respondent's argument other than inferentially, and that is this idea that prior cancellation may not tell you anything. USAA's decision to insure officers and their families only doesn't tell you anything about the risk possibility of enlisted personnel whom they don't insure. The Attorney General and the board from the outset have tried to inject into this record the issue of risk and to use that as a basis, totally unstated in the board's order, as the basis for trying to uphold Rule 1000. The board representative testified time and again from the witness stand that underwriting guidelines do not have to be based on risk. They can be based on marketing decisions. They can be based on perception of risk. And you will not find in the board order any effort to provide the factual basis for Rule 1000 as being bottomed on risk. And the effort to do so, even though the Attorney General and everyone recognizes that the reasoned justification requirement must be based within the four corners of the order, they now and have always tried to inject this risk argument.
Counsel argues that you would prohibit any agency from doing prophylactic or prospective rulemaking. What's your response to that?
Absolutely not so. The occurrence does not have to be the factual basis, the restatement of a rule's factual basis. In addition to all the other problems with these rules, what is missing in this case is a restatement or a statement of the factual basis as to why the practices that are proscribed are unfair. If you look at the definition of what's required to find an unfair trade practice as promulgated by the Federal Trade Commission, you won't find the State Board of Insurance trying to suggest that top side and their bottom, much less make any recitations of those factors in the board order. So it's not just the factual basis of occurrence that is a problem. That is merely one facet of the bigger issue, and that is the failure to tell us why these are unfair trade practices when companies can accept officers only, or they can rewrite sports cars or old cars. And every time they do that, and the board representative says that to the gentleman, every time they do that under Rule 1003, they, prior to the legislature's action, faced a treble damage lawsuit that the reason they were denied insurance was because of the number of cars.
Well, that's no longer an issue.
But administrative penalties are $25,000 per violation is an issue, a very big issue.
When insurance companies are now required to go beyond a cancellation of another company, what information is available presently that would tell a company that another company had refused to ride and the reason? Is there some?
No, it may be information that can't be found out. And what you do when the applicant says, oh yes, I was canceled, I don't know why, and I can't remember the company, and no, I don't, you know, that's all you have. So there's not a body of information out there available.
That information is not available from the company that canceled.
It might be if the company is still there and will divulge it, consistent with whatever confidentiality concerns they may have. So it's just not a body of information out there that's readily available. But the point is, if one company had that guideline, and there's no evidence anybody did, The evidence showed there are hundreds of competing companies out here in the state of Texas to which any applicant may go and obtain insurance. So there was no evidence that there was anything unfair. And the board didn't even try to find that these practices were deceptive.
Well, at some point, I guess, if all the insurance companies decided that they would not offer insurance to somebody who had been canceled by another insurance company, then there would be a question of availability, wouldn't there?
There would be as to those people who had previously been canceled if there was some sort of conspiracy of that nature.
And why doesn't this enhance availability?
Why doesn't it enhance
availability?
Well, let me say it this way. The eradication and prohibition of any underwriting guideline will enhance availability. And that's what the board seeks to do. It's one of the things they seek to do in this order. So this, and I don't say this lightly, and I don't say it with any fear that it would happen presently, but this was an enormous effort by that board to make that incursion upon the ability of companies like USAA. If you had a guideline that said it's unfair for a company just to write military officers, that would enhance the availability of insurance tremendously. If you had a guideline that said it's unfair not to write sports cars or high-powered cars or that sort of thing, it would advance the availability of insurance tremendously. So one of the biggest dangers with this case. I regret that I don't have time to read you the reason, justification, and show you that there is no compliance in either of those efforts with the requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act.
Any other questions? Thank you. That completes the arguments in today's causes. All of them are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
Audience.